It's to the best of our knowledge from PRI. This hour, after life. You know, nobody knows what happens after we die. Maybe nothing, but a lot of people think maybe something does. Judgment at the pearly gates, an endless walkabout in the afterlife, karmic rebirth. Wherever you go, people have ideas about life after life.
So I was in this village called Benchong in eastern Nepal, and I heard that a boy in the village had fallen. Apparently, he was cutting fodder from some of the higher branches on a tree, and he fell from the tree onto a layer of stones on his back, and he was paralyzed.
Sometimes, encountering another culture's beliefs can change what you think about life and death. Jeffrey Potter was filming in a tiny village in Nepal back in 2000 when he witnessed the death of a boy named Harka. He was not expecting what happened next.
I sat with him and I watched his lungs, I suppose, fill with fluid until, you know, his eyes rolled back and, you know, I think those were his last breaths. The funeral would be the next day, and so as the evening wore on, fewer and fewer people were awake, and I decided to make a little room for myself and curl up there. And I had a dream that Harka came to me. And so he said, I'd like to say goodbye to my mother. Can I just borrow your body? I'll come in through you and communicate to my mother, and then I'll go. And in my dream, I started to feel him come into my body. And I could feel in my dream that I was starting to panic. And so I told him, get out, you know, get out of my body. I don't want to do this. And I awoke from that dream, and on my lips was a Kulung word, mother. I think it was really that moment when I woke up and I realized it was a dream, and there was Harka's body just a few feet away from me, and this dark, smoke-filled house on this cold winter night, and yeah, Harka came to me. When the sun came up, everything became very different. The elders sort of oversee the funeral. A shallow grave is dug near the house. And then really it's sort of up to the community as a whole with the leadership of the elders to show him the path and to basically say, you've got to go find this. Leave us and find the path. Because the desire of that spirit to stay where it's known and where it's comfortable, even if it can't communicate, even if it can't connect, is very strong. And so the idea is to make it so the spirit doesn't want to stay. I'm a different person when I'm in Nepal. There's no doubt about it for me. And I guess I feel that there's so much of our life that's explained for us here. And that if you can't find an explanation for something, it's not hard to find somebody who will explain it for you. And not all of Nepal is like the community where I've lived and worked for most of my time there, but the mysteries of life, I think, are a little more present. And, you know, death is the great mystery of life. And as much as we may try to answer it here in the United States or the developed world, I don't think we have a better answer for it than any other place that I've lived and been. And in Nepal, when I'm there experiencing the same things that they are, I find myself searching for answers as well.
Jeffrey Potter has been working and filming in the same village in eastern Nepal since 1994. So how do we make sense of that sudden absence when someone dies? Faith traditions offer some explanations, but fundamentally, we all live in the face of a giant question mark. How do we deal with that? Roshi Joan Halifax is a Zen Buddhist abbot who's been sitting with dying people since 1970. And in her view, that unknown is a gift.
I was just in Nepal with a wonderful doctor named Gary Pasternak, who's medical director at Mission Hospice in California. And he had just sat with several of his patients who died. And I could tell the mystery of death was really present for him as we were in the Himalayas taking care of people in our medical clinics. It was really, really incredible.
What do you mean by the mystery of death?
Like, you know, there's where we something, go? No, it's not where we go. It's really a kind of inexplicable process when you see the last breath run out of a body. There's a kind of both finality in that moment, and there's also, you know, as I use the word mystery, there's a kind of mystery. There are frames of reference in the Tibetan Buddhist perspective and other spiritual perspectives, which, you know, give us some sense of what might be the case of or the situation with consciousness at the moment of death and after death. But, you know, also, I seriously don't know.
Yeah.
And so it's that sense of not knowing that I think is very difficult for some people to live with, but I actually like it.
When you said there are frames of reference within the Tibetan tradition, can you say more?
Well, I'm not a Tibetan Buddhist. I'm a Zen Buddhist. Yeah. But it's something I've explored in certain ways. You know, from the Tibetan Buddhist perspective, the mind has many inflections, including a very subtle aspect, which is not extinguished in the dying process.
Do you mean you think consciousness continues?
Well, you know, what's fascinating is we can compare it to sleep. For example, we have, when we put ourselves into our little bed at night, like I did last night, very tired, and so I fell asleep quite quickly. And as I was falling asleep, I was aware of this process of letting go that happens in the body, deep relaxation, and then letting go. And then suddenly, you know, everything was kind of extinguished. And then as the night unfolded, something else happened, which was the dream state unfolded. And what the Tibetan Buddhists relate this to is this process of falling asleep and then awakening within the reality of the dream. And there's some kind of continuity of consciousness from the point of view of what the Tibetan yogis have understood that persists. I mean, all of this is really fascinating to me. And even Tolstoy, by the way, you know, in his short novel, The Death of Ivan Ilyich, mm-hmm. it's fascinating how, as Ilyich, his protagonist, is dying this really miserable death. And at a certain point in the very late phases of dying, he sort of drops through into a pain-free state and then into luminosity, where internally he says there is no death. So, you know, this all makes dying easier for people. It also is a great inspiration to practice. It's something that, you know, is being looked at by science in terms of what's called tukdum, which is these extraordinary practitioners who, after the moment of physical death, actually continue to have, if you will, signs of life. The body doesn't decay, the heart area stays warm, and so on. So,
have you seen this?
I've never seen a person in tukdum, but of course I've read about it and I've seen photographs. And actually, I talked with a renowned neuroscientist last night, and he was in the presence of a great lama who was in tukdum. So I was very...
So what happens?
I don't know. But I mean, what happens is the body stays very, very fresh for many days. after the actual moment of decease. I'm very interested in this.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows?
You know, but that's also, I'm also curious because if consciousness, spirit, some other essence of us can continue on, you'd think the body would just drop away like meat.
I don't know. I honestly don't know. And as I said, I've been in this field now since 1970. So that's, you know, a long time, sitting with dying people, training caregivers.
So what do you think dying is like?
I think it's different for every single person, is what I think it's like. I think the point of practice in relation to dying is to actually create the conditions in the human mind where you're able to be present, to bear witness to open to whatever arises.
What do you think will arise for you?
I don't know. And I live with that sensibility. I have no idea.
Well, then what does it mean if you don't know to think of death as liberation?
Because that experience of not knowing is itself liberation. In other words, I, as I keep saying, feel death is a mystery. But I also feel life is a mystery.
Roshi Joan Halifax is the founding abbot of the Upaya Zen Center in Santa Fe. She's also a medical anthropologist and director of the Project on Being with Dying. So most religious traditions teach that there is some kind of life after death, that there's an undying part of us, a soul or spirit that goes somewhere. Those beliefs actually predate modern religion and even human history. Alan Kelleher is a sociologist who studies the psychology, science, and history of dying all the way back to the Stone Age. He told Steve Paulson that for tens of thousands of years, hunter-gatherer cultures have believed dying is a journey, which begins after death.
Many societies think about dying as not something that happens to the body, but dying as the annihilation of your identity. So the dying occurs post-death in most hunter-gatherer societies. If you look at their myths and legends across a whole range of human societies, you'll see that dying was something that occurred when you appeared in the supernatural world. In Fiji, for example, if you never married, there was a spinster god or a spinster monster, if you like, that would try to kill you on your journey towards heaven, if you like, or the perfect world. So your dying would occur post-death.
Why would that not be considered just the afterlife, something that happens after death? Why would that all be considered part of the dying process?
Well, in historical religions like Christianity or Hinduism and Buddhism or any of those kinds of recent historical religions, you can't really be killed in the afterlife.
Right.
It's only the hunter-gatherers who seem to think that the real dying, the annihilation of your personality, the cessation of your existence, occurs after your body has been destroyed. Now, that's a very peculiar take if you compare it with modern ways of thinking about dying. When I use the word modern, I mean since the last ice age, the last 12,000 years.
What's the evidence for how we know these things about how people thought about dying back more than 10,000 years ago?
Burial sites. And there's been an extensive study of grave goods all around the world. And not just goods that represent the grief of survivors, but also they're giving gifts to the dead to actually use. For example, spears.
you need a spear in the afterlife.
Why
right?
would you need a spear in the afterlife? Now, this suggests a set of beliefs about dying as a post-death journey, which ended in the real death 50, 100, 300 days after the destruction of their body. And that's fairly cross-cultural.
What would people need to do in this post-death dying process, this journey where it sounds like, they're on some sort of quest?
Yeah. Well, again, you've got to look at this kind of thing society for society. The Fijians have a different view of this to the Kalahari Bushmen, for example. They would have a different set of legends, different gods to dodge, different evils to worry about. So many hunter-gatherer societies are animists, and they believe there's life in the rock and the tree and the sky and the sun and the moon. And if you talk to the Australian Aborigines, they'll point to a tree and say, that was my uncle. That snake there was, my great-great-grandfather. So transformation, the idea of moving through different forms and that life is a cycle, is a widespread belief in hunter-gatherer cultures.
Well, one thing that's striking about this whole history that you've been talking about is there was an assumption that the afterlife was a given. Immortality existed regardless of what culture you're talking about.
Yes.
I mean, the whole this modern idea that as we've come to live in more secular societies, that maybe everything just ends at the point of biological death. I mean, that's actually a radically new idea.
Yeah. Look, I don't believe the materialist view that in modern society we've moved away from religion. You look at any of the major surveys in the United States and Britain, you'll find high numbers of people have a belief in God or have spiritual beliefs that entail the afterlife, some private view of destiny and divinity.
I know you have spent a lot of time with people who are dying. Do they tend to have transformative experiences emotionally or spiritually in their final days or weeks or months?
Yes. I mean, some people have felt that odd things have happened. They've had mystical experiences. They've had strange lights in their room. They may be lying in bed and they get visit from a dead child or a dead parent or an old dead friend. They're called deathbed visions.
And these are common?
Well, in Eastern European and Asian studies we have suggests the prevalence is 1 in 3.
Wow.
The British studies we have suggest 1 in 10. And that's because I think largely we use a lot more opiates and also the designs of the study are quite different. But some of the transformative experiences, and you use the phrase transformative experiences, some of these things come unbidden, which is to say you're not seeking them. You know, you work every day in radio or whatever it is you do and you come home at night and your life is pretty banal. You don't expect anything strange. You certainly don't expect to see your dead father coming to see you in the evening, right? You're not that kind of guy. I'm not that kind of guy. And you could say, well, maybe these are hallucinations. Well, maybe they are. But what the issue is that they are transformative. They're thought-provoking. They make you rethink what you think reality is. They make you rethink what you think you know about dying.
I have to ask, are you a religious person yourself?
I am not.
Would you describe yourself as having some sort of spiritual orientation?
I'm a maybe person. You know, the world is populated by people who say yes and no. And I'm an advocate for the maybes, or it's possible. Fundamentally, at the basis of this type of research into mystical experiences is the question of what we are as human beings. Nothing short of that question is what we're dealing with here. So anybody who thinks they've got the answer to that by 5 o'clock this afternoon is trying to sell you something. It's that simple, mate.
let me rephrase the question with perhaps a more pointed way of asking it. Given all that you've seen, all the people you've talked to, all these stories that you've heard, Do you think consciousness can survive the physical death of the brain?
It may well do. That's my answer.
But, okay, let me press you on this. I mean, you've just told me these remarkable stories, these cross-cultural stories of these, these mystical experiences. Why wouldn't you believe that?
Well, because I also listen to my materialist colleagues who put up the objections, who trace the physiology of things, who make the argument that these are possibly subsets of hallucinations. They cannot be dismissed. So there is a balancing act in all good research. There's a balancing act. You need to look at the arguments for and the arguments against. I happen to think that there is sufficient evidence when you look at all the research as a whole, and I have looked at all the research as a whole, when you look at the research as a whole, there is evidence to suggest these are more than hallucinations. So what this gives me is a couple of things which are not very valued these days. One is openness. Two is optimism, that we may be more than our flesh.
So you would like there to be more than the flesh?
Yeah, I think I would. Yes, I don't think I'd like to go to the grave and rot. I'm quite prepared to do that if that's the way it is, if that's the way the universe works. But I just don't know enough to feel I could sell anything more than there is hope that there is more than we can see and measure.
Alan Kelleher is a medical and public health sociologist at Middlesex University in London. His books include A Social History of Dying and The Inner Life of the Dying Person. You can hear Steve's full conversation with him on our website at ttbook.org/death. Sign up for the podcast while you're there.
Our series on death is supported by the Neuer Foundation, dedicated to exploring meaning and commonality in human experience. More at neuerfoundation.com. and by Promega Corporation, investigating and supporting the science of life.
We're talking this hour about what happens after life. And one way the dead live on is in tangible memorials, gravestones, photo albums, commemorative celebrations, and even Facebook, which turns out to be the one place where it's actually kind of hard to die. Religious scholar Candy Can studies our virtual afterlives. She told Steve Paulson that social media is transforming death.
So right now, it's currently estimated that there are 1 million dead Facebook users. In other words, they are people that started a Facebook page and then died. And the family and the friends can go online, write messages to the deceased, talk to the deceased, post pictures on the deceased's webpage.
It almost sounds like you're saying they do this as if the deceased is still living.
Yes, exactly. It's very interesting because I think the language that people utilize on social network memorials is very similar to the language that we would hear at the gravestone, as though there is an audience and the audience is the deceased person.
Now, one of the things that I find interesting is that there are memorial sites for celebrities or victims of tragic events. For instance, one of the victims of the Boston Marathon bombings had her Facebook memorial page flooded by comments, hundreds of thousands of comments just days after the event. I mean, mostly from people who never knew this person.
Yes, after Crystal Campbell was killed in the Boston Marathon bombing, a page was set up in her memory. And people who knew her posted pictures, but there were thousands, hundreds of thousands of messages written to her, written to her family. And it was also, the language was very much present tense, second person, kind of I and you. It wasn't talking about her like an obituary would place a person into the past. So this is one of the big differences I think that has emerged with social media. It views on some level the deceased as continuing to live and continuing to be the recipient of these messages.
Which seems kind of odd, doesn't it?
Yes, I find it very different. But I actually think that people have talked to the deceased for as long as we can remember. It's just that we never before listened in. And that's what social network memorials have allowed us to do. We can partake in this conversation. So I think that it's not the conversation that's different. It's the fact that it's now public that's different.
Well, you tell a story about one woman who actually got kind of irritated when after her husband died, and a lot of his friends were posting all of these condolences to him, not to her. And she felt like, well, you know, she was the one who was grieving the most, and, you know, shouldn't they be addressing her?
Right. And she said that people weren't sending her letters. Rather, they were all communing together on her husband's Facebook page. And that was bothersome to her because she, and rightly so, wanted to be the center of the attention during the mourning period because her loss, she felt, was the greatest. You know, she was the one who woke up every day and felt his absence first and went to sleep at night and didn't have him to turn to.
Well, and then there's the larger question of, okay, someone has had a Facebook page, that person has died. I would think it's not at all uncommon that some people would say, you know, I don't want that Facebook profile to keep on.
Right. And Facebook actually has a process through which you can memorialize a page. So you can contact their department and have it shut down. And it basically, it just becomes frozen in time. If you don't do that, then you may get requests to play a game or to interact with your deceased friend's friends. And what they call those is the internet ghost or the Facebook ghost. That can be a really strange and unsettling kind of encounter. My grandfather regularly interacts with me on Facebook, and he died several years ago. But I get requests to play games with him, and it's a little bit unsettling when I get those requests.
What kinds of requests do you get?
For example, if you like a particular page, let's say you like Target, Facebook can then send out requests to your friends. Steve likes Target. Do you want to like Target too? But your response will be, well, Steve's no longer with us. And so I'm not sure why Steve's inviting me to like this page. So it can be a little bit unsettling in that respect.
Yeah. So are we seeing new kinds of rituals or customs that are involved in observing death on the internet or through social media?
Well, I think we are. So there are several different things. You know, one of them is the move towards visual rhetoric, pictures either of the deceased with the griever, which symbolizes that person's right to grieve, or of the deceased in their casket with the griever. And that's the whole issue on funeral selfies that a lot of people have had problems with lately.
So this is kind of strange, I have to say. I mean, there's a body in a casket and the person at the funeral service there is taking a selfie of the two of them together.
Yeah, I think it is strange, but it's actually not out of context because ever since the emergence of photography 150 years ago, death photography has been very popular. So before, the family, let's say their child died, they would take a picture of their child as a family portrait, and then they would bury the child. But, you know, they weren't posting that photograph on Twitter or posting it on Facebook. And what's so upsetting about the funeral selfies, I think, for most people, is the interruption of death. You're at work and you're checking your Facebook. You're at home on a Sunday afternoon checking your Facebook on your phone while your son plays ball in the yard. And then all of a sudden you encounter this dead body. And I think that's what's disturbing, the fact that death interrupts us.
Well, one of the things you write about is that some of these things we've been talking about, these kinds of virtual memorials, go way back. I mean, yes, the technology is new, but the idea is often not new. I mean, in terms of how people have grieved in the United States.
Right. You know, these funeral selfies are kind of a replication of the armband or the mourning clothing. They're just a desire to be recognized as someone who's grieving, because now at work we only have maybe, if we're lucky, 3 to 5 days off from work. And that's not enough time to get the funeral put in place and the estate put in order. So, yeah, I do think that these new things, they may be new technologies, but I think they're actually just a resurfacing of old forms of grieving.
Candy Can is a religion professor at Baylor University. She talked with Steve Paulson about her book, Virtual Afterlives. So today, your Facebook page can live on after you die, giving you a kind of virtual immortality. But what if the digital world could confer literal immortality? There's this theory called the singularity, the idea that at some point humans and computers will merge and we'll be able to upload our thoughts and memories to some kind of undying silicon and live forever. Transhumanists like James Hughes not only think this is a great idea, they also think it's entirely possible. Charles Monroe Kane asked for a few specifics.
How far back do you think we can push death? I mean, 1,000 years, 100 years, forever?
Well, we will eventually have indefinite lifespans. There will always be accidents and self-chosen death, and then eventually the heat death of the universe. So, there's cosmic events that we probably will never be able to control. But for most people, there will be an indefinite prolongation of life.
Without splitting hairs over the word immortal, I mean, you are saying that we're not going to die.
Yes, it's a little bit more complicated than that, because the question is, who are you? I mean, one of the things that will happen is that we will be radically transforming and passing our memories along to things that we currently can't even imagine and may not recognize as being us in the future. So, you know, the question becomes kind of philosophical about what survival means.
Well, what about our bodies? I mean, are those even going to exist anymore? And is it foolish to define being alive or dead is based on this thing, this carbon thing?
I think we'll get over the notion that you have to have a meat-based body in order to exist. That's probably one of the least stable forms of incarnation that's possible. And so most of the intelligent life in the universe has probably migrated into more stable forms of artificial intelligence, and we probably will as well.
And do you see us, and is it a science fiction thing that we all know, being the cyborg, or is it something like basically you say we can't even fathom?
Well, some people probably will prefer to live in a virtual world. That's, in fact, one of the explanations for why there may not be visible signs of intelligent life in the universe, is that the attractions of living in a virtual world as opposed to actually exploring space may be too great, and that intelligent species just kind of disappear into virtuality.
They're smart enough just to not be here at all. Like, yeah, right. I'm going to take off. Oh, wait. In science today, things that are literally existing now, what do you see as the technology that's going to take us there?
Well, the first step is for all of us who are currently alive to do the things which we know work, which is exercise, eat right, don't take stupid risks like smoking, and to survive long enough for the promises of technology to pay off. One of the first sets of promises will be therapies that prolong healthy longevity. And that's already been happening over the course of the last century and in, you know, 70s, the new 50, et cetera, et cetera. But we want drugs and devices and therapies that will push that even further. Then the next stage, I think, will be tiny little robots that we release into the body that will be able to find cancers and zap them, that will be able to fix sclerotic arteries, that will be able to go into the brain and zap Alzheimer's plaques. And eventually we'll be able to set up a kind of virtual network inside your head that will allow your brain to communicate with computers and begin to back up and assist your thinking.
Yeah, that's incredible. I was wondering, you know, you were talking about we wouldn't even necessarily be ourselves anymore. But if you're not yourself anymore, then what about your memories? Because in some ways, the memories I have, isn't that who I am?
Right. Well, this question was first asked by John Locke 350 years ago. He said, when God resurrects human beings at the end of time for the judgment, will he have to pull back together all our atoms, or won't he just pull back together our memories? Because the only thing we really have to be judged is our memories of our life. That's a fundamental question. Is, are we a body? Are we this particular kind of meat that we exist in now? Or are we, in fact, a psychological thing, a thing of memory? And if that's all we are, then A, when you lose that, you also lose yourself. And B, if you can preserve that in various forms, not just as books or, you know, video recordings or something like that, but in a, say, in a computer, then you continue to exist as well.
Well, let's talk about computers for a second, because, I mean, you can't help the analogy here. You know, if I live for 5,000 years, that's a lot of memories. I'm going to have some way to organize it. Do I just become a computer? And that doesn't even sound like that much fun to me.
Well, the current notion of becoming a computer sounds soulless and that you wouldn't have the experience of having a body,
right,
and all the pleasures and so forth. But that's not what people are imagining, really. It's that you would be able to reconstitute all the experiences and all the sensations of being a living person inside a virtual self. And then you could decide which ones you wanted to keep and which ones you didn't. Maybe you give up hunger. Maybe you give up, you know, itchiness or something, you know.
Sounds reasonable. Okay.
Right. You know, meditators, and I'm a meditator, one of the things that we value about certain meditative experiences is when you lose the sense of having a body, you become one with everything. So it may be that once people make that migration into virtual existence, that they'll have greater access to those kinds of spiritual experiences.
Now, I read you're a Buddhist, right?
Mm-hmm.
At first, I was like, wait a minute, anything that's religious at any level connected with what you're writing about makes no sense at all. And then I thought, Buddhism, Buddhist. And I'm like, oh my God, this makes complete sense. How do you connect the two?
Well, it's probably going to take me at least 10,000 years to reach enlightenment. So that's the first connection.
Okay, fair enough. Okay.
And also, Buddhism is, at its core, a faith that human beings, through their own effort, can achieve transcendence. And the Buddha never said that you had to eschew all the benefits of technology and
right.
medicine. In fact, Buddhism's been very embracing of science and medicine.
So do you see transcendence as transhumanism? Are they two things in one for you? Like, okay, by achieving one, you achieve the other?
Well, I kind of boil it down to the serenity prayer. Buddhism is about, primarily, about accepting the things that you can't change and having the serenity about that. And transhumanism is mostly about the courage to change the things that we can. We are at the cusp of a technological revolution which would allow everyone lives on this planet of leisure and abundance and healthy longevity. And we should have the courage to do that.
You know, there are people out there, and there's lots of them, you know them, who say that death is what gives life meaning, that finite lifespan is what makes us who we are. What do you say to those folks?
Well, then they would have been even happier in Paleolithic period than they would be today, you know, because our ancestors faced death a lot sooner, a lot more frequently, a lot more violently than we do today. I think, in fact, we're a lot happier today than our Paleolithic ancestors were, you know, carrying around their fleas and with all their teeth rotting out. And the notion that you have to have pestilence and disease and war in order to be happy and to appreciate life is just an incredibly short-sighted view. There will always be unrequited love. There will always be things that you can't have. There's only so much beachfront property. There's only so many people who can fly to the moon. So there will always be things that we want that we can't have. And human beings are very creative at stepping up their desires to face their current situation.
James Hughes is the author of Citizen Cyborg and executive director of the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Charles Monroe Kane talked with him. So I don't know, living on inside a computer, maybe to some people that sounds like virtual heaven or maybe virtual hell. Last year we ran a short science fiction contest and we asked you for 3-minute stories set in the future. The single most popular topic was digital immortality. I read every one of those stories, and I can tell you, nobody thought it would turn out well. From San Francisco, Mark Pantoja sent us this story. It's called Reset.
Yeah, document's a little behind schedule, but it's shaping up.
Can we review it in the next hour?
No. Sorry about the delay. I'll send it your way this afternoon.
Okay.
Just make a quick call, and we'll wrap things up.
Great.
Thanks.
Welcome back to ReLife. Would you like to talk to a loved one?
I can only talk to her for a few minutes before she starts to ask all the wrong questions and get upset. I could dumb it down, but then that's not who Abigail was. She was always smart, always sharp, always a step ahead.
I'll get Abigail on the line.
I talked to her on the phone. When she was alive, it was always text or chat or video. I think that's the first thing that sets her off.
What's so important you had to call?
They got her voice right, copied from cell phone and YouTube videos.
This is what happens when you try to message me.
And they got her pauses and inflection and laughs down perfectly. There wasn't much of her mind left to trawl after the accident. So they rendered her from tweets and reviews and comments and likes and Netflix categories and all the crap they used to peddle.
So cute.
Useless garbage to her.
This is the best thing all week.
They reverse engineered her with marketing.
I just thought of you. I heart you.
We talk until she starts to complain about not being able to check her email.
Why won't my apps refresh?
She never guesses. Who guesses they're a simulation? But she knows something's wrong.
Where's Mom? Can I talk to her? Why did you call me, Dad? Where are you? Dad? Dad, where are you?
I don't know where she is. In the ground? On a server in Russia?
Dad?
I'm sorry, baby. I just wanted to hear your voice.
Where am I?
There are questions I can't ask. I don't want to know the answers.
I feel like I'm in a movie or something.
I always end the conversation before any crying. Would she cry?
I don't know where to begin.
Does her simulation feel anything?
I'm confused sometimes.
Sometimes I think of letting her go. Erasing her.
What is up with you? What is up with this?
How many dark rooms out there are filled with people endlessly replaying loved ones? Or Michael Jackson. Or Elvis.
Why aren't you saying anything?
Would you like to save this conversation?
But I never do. I always factory reset my daughter. So we have the same conversation, day after day. The same brief few minutes when everything is like it was. I had her rendered so I could tell her how much I love her and tell her goodbye. But I can't do it. I can't let go.
I miss you. Hugs!
Was she always so affectionate? It's hard to remember what she was like before. Sometimes I wonder how well they've marketed to me.
We should hang more often.
The story is called Reset by listener Mark Pantoja. Acted by Bruce Bradley and Lila Rivard-Hoster, with sound design by Joe Hartke. You know, before computers, people who wanted to live forever invented cryogenics, which today seems kind of bizarre. But did you know there are actual cryogenics labs in this country and others with real frozen bodies waiting in tanks for their eventual longed-for resurrection? Photographer Murray Ballard takes us inside some of those facilities in a collection called Prospects of Immortality. And you can see his work and hear our interview with him in our online photo gallery. You'll find it at ttbook.org/death. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now, a thought experiment. Philosopher Sam Scheffler has a question that he's been asking his friends, colleagues, and students, which kind of reframes the whole concept of the afterlife.
The first thought experiment asks you to imagine that although you will live to a ripe old age and die peacefully in your sleep, the world and all of its inhabitants will be destroyed 30 days after your death in a collision with a giant asteroid. Most people do not say, oh, well, you know, I won't be around, so who cares? Most people agree that it would be quite devastating and demoralizing news. And then the question is what exactly to make of that and what exactly the effects would be on people. Suddenly, or so it seems to me, lots of activities would just seem pointless. Our capacity to find value in our lives now and in our lives and activities seems to depend more on our confidence in the survival of the human race than it does on our own survival and the survival of our loved ones. And that is a quite striking thing to recognize. The effect of thinking about these kinds of thought experiments is to make me think it's not just that those future generations, those descendants, are dependent on us. We are dependent on them. We need them. We need them to go on living and ideally to thrive and to flourish in order for our sense of the value of what we're doing to be sustained. And so it gives us a different perspective from which to assess the value of our lives. The value of our lives isn't just a checklist of achievements, you know, as if we paste on our tombstones our resume, and if we've got a lot of impressive things on our resume, then we had a really good life, you know. It's not like that. I mean, you think about sort of how there's another phenomenon here that we pay a lot less attention to, and that is just the significance to us of this other kind of afterlife, of the significance to us of the assumption that life on Earth will continue after we ourselves are gone. And that's something that we normally just take for granted. And because we take it for granted, we don't really think about its significance.
Samuel Scheffler is a philosopher at New York University. He's the author of Death and the Afterlife. And we're running his thought experiment online, so take a look, tell us what you think, and see what everyone else has to say. You'll find it at ttbook.org/death. Click on Listener Stories to find the survey. And throughout this series on death, we've been following the story of Dan Perotti and his wife Judy. Today, Seth Jovag brings us the final installment, Remembering Dan.
I've always had a kind of holy mackerel idea, feeling about my life. you know, this little kid from, skinny little kid from Kane, Pennsylvania. And here I am with seven children, six grandchildren, living a very comfortable life. It's really rather amazing.
I only knew Dan 6 months, but before he died, I learned that he was a funny, generous guy who adored his wife, Judy. After his funeral was over and the guests were gone, Judy went home to a pile of paperwork, condolence cards, and solitude. I stopped by a couple of weeks later to see how she was doing.
Seth, there's a big part that feels relief. I had 8 months to prepare for this, 8 months to mourn. Dan was slipping away, and I was worried about feeling lonely, and I have not felt lonely. And there are times that, you know, I wish I could share things with him. He had an incredible memory, and somebody asked me something recently, and I thought, oh, too bad Dan's not here because he'd know the answer and I can't remember. You know, those family stories, except for the ones that I recorded, all of that is gone now.
2 years earlier, Judy had recorded Dan talking about his life, about working as a Lutheran minister, about leaving the church, about being a father. They also talked about his death and what would come after it.
How would you like to be remembered by your family and your friends?
Family, I would like them to remember me the way I remember my father. You know, with love and happiness that they knew me. Friends, I hope they remember me for my sense of humor and constancy. I worry about you, by the way, about it.
You want to say more about that?
Yeah, I think that you exhaust yourself and you don't think about that.
When I stopped by, Judy was just getting off the phone with a credit card company, arguing over some of Dan's accounts. Her to-do list was on the kitchen counter, and it was long. But when I asked her how she was doing, she said that she'd slept in that morning, and she was planning vacations that she never could have taken while Dan was sick. She was doing okay, and she was working on remembering Dan when he was in his prime.
I have a lot of energy, but the Dan that I first met, I couldn't keep up with the guy. And that's the Dan that I want to remember. You know, he was playful and whimsical, and I don't, when I met him, I don't think the man had a savings account, because that he never cared about money. And, you know, the interesting thing is that after he died, and the children wanted something to remember him by, and I said, well, go through his dresser, take whatever you want. Do you know that all they found were handkerchiefs?
Oh, no.
That's what they each took. They took a handkerchief. The man had nothing, which is so appropriate in so many ways.
That's how Dan was. He wasn't worried about where his stuff would end up after he died. As for where he'd end up, well, Dan kind of thought he'd be everywhere.
I believe that when I'm buried, dead and buried, whatever I am, all this energy and mass and stuff, becomes something else. Just some energy floating around.
So I asked Judy, what does she think happens to us after we die? Where do you think Dan is now?
Oh, this is a question I've struggled with my entire adult life, and I still don't have an answer. I too believe that we can't totally disappear. So there's something there. But I'm still grappling with that. I don't know. Oh, I feel his presence a lot. I mean, just look around the house and he's everywhere. I feel his absence. I feel both his presence and his absence. Yeah.
That was Judy Perotti talking about her late husband, Dan. Seth Jovag brought us their story. And you can hear the whole complete story online at ttbook.org/death. And this music, by the way, was written for us by Freddie Knope. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. So for the past 5 weeks, you and we have made room in our lives to think and talk about death and dying. I'd like to believe that having these conversations can make a difference, can help bring death out of the shadows so we don't all wind up encountering it alone. The series is coming to an end on the radio, but it too has an afterlife, online. There are interviews on our website that we never got on air. There are amazing photo galleries with work by four outstanding contemporary photographers. They're the stories and photos you shared with us, resource pages, and so much more. If you have found anything of value in these hours, I hope you'll consider sharing them. Invite your friends and family and larger circle to download the podcast or visit the website. It's at ttbook.org/death. And the series on death was produced by all of us here at To the Best of Our Knowledge. Sarah Nix, Doug Gordon, Raymond Tungekar, Charles Monroe Kane, Craig Ely, our amazing technical director, Kirill Owen, our executive producer, Steve Paulson. Our opening theme music is by Steve Mullen from WalkWest Music, and those online photography galleries were curated by FLAC photo editor Andy Adams. I'm Anne Strainchamps. As always, thank you so much for being here with us.
PRI, Public Radio International.